We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
These are three of the most chilling and unexplained child disappearances ever recorded. Real cases that left behind no footprints, no witnesses, and no clues. Only fear and unanswered questions. One moment they were right there, the next gone, as if they vanished into thin air. Decades later, even top investigators are still haunted by what they found. These three real-life stories are so haunting. They defy all logic. And to this day, not a single one has been truly explained. This is not just another mystery video. This will chill you to your core. June 1983, a peaceful family picnic in Montana's Helena National Forest takes a tragic turn. 4-year-old Nyleen was playing just a few feet away from the adults when, in the blink of an eye, she vanished without a sound. No scream. No struggle. Just gone. Search teams flooded the forest. Helicopters scanned from above. Hundreds combed the woods for days. Nothing. Then, silence for years. But out of nowhere, a strange letter arrives. And what it said would turn the entire case upside down. Nyleen K. Briscoe was born on September 18, 1978. To Bill and Nancy Briscoe. After her parents separated, Nancy married a new husband, Kim Marshall, who later adopted Nyleen. Her name then became Nyleen K. Marshall. She grew up with her parents, her older brother Nathan, and her younger sister Noreen. They lived in Alhambra, Montana, and were known as a happy, typical American Mormon family. On Saturday, June 25, 1983, the Marshall family went to a ham radio event held at a picnic spot in the Elkhorn Mountains. The event was organized by the Capital City Radio Club, which Kim Marshall was a member of. Children's laughter echoed through the towering pines of Helena National Forest. It was supposed to be a perfect day, the kind of day that creates treasured family memories. At approximately 4 p.m., Nyleen was playing near the beaver dams on Maupin Creek. She wore simple summer clothes, shorts, and a t-shirt, perfect for a carefree afternoon of exploration. She and two other children investigated the remains of an old cabin, a relic from Montana's frontier past. But something was watching from the shadows of those ancient trees, something that would shatter the Marshall family forever. The other children walked ahead toward the beaver dams, their voices growing distant as they explored. Nyleen, with her characteristic dimpled smile and that distinctive chipped baby tooth, lingered behind. She was fascinated by something, or someone. When the other children turned around just moments later, expecting to see her following, they found only empty forest. Nyleen Marshall had vanished as completely as if the earth had swallowed her whole. The panic that gripped the Marshall family in that moment is something no parent should ever experience. One second your child is there, the next, nothing. Just silence where laughter used to be. Within hours, what would become the most massive search operation in the area's history was mobilized. The Jefferson County Sheriff's Office immediately called for backup from Lewis and Clark search and rescue teams. This wasn't just a case of a lost child anymore. This felt different. More urgent. More terrifying. Helicopters with heat-sensing devices thundered overhead, their mechanical roar drowning out the natural sounds of the forest. Hundreds of volunteers arrived, their faces etched with determination and dread. They formed search lines and began the painstaking process of combing through every inch of the rugged terrain. Duke, a specially trained search dog with an incredible track record, was brought in. This wasn't just any dog. Duke had successfully located 37 missing persons during his career. If anyone could find Eileen, it would be Duke and his handler. But when Duke picked up a scent, something chilling happened. The dog followed the trail for just a short distance before losing it completely. It was as if Eileen had simply disappeared, vanished in a thin air. The searchers didn't give up. They drained beaver dams, their hands numb from the cold mountain water. They crawled through dense undergrowth on their hands and knees, thorns tearing at their clothes and skin. They rappelled into mine shafts, calling Nylene's name into the echoing darkness below. They searched mountain ridges where the wind howled like a banshee. But the forest was keeping its secrets. Then, as if nature itself was conspiring against them, the skies opened up. Rain poured down in torrents, turning the search area into a muddy nightmare. Evidence, if there had been any, was now washing away down mountain streams. Hope was washing away with it. Lewis and Clark County Search Coordinator Ralph DeKunzen said in a newspaper that the bushes in the area were so thick that searchers could have walked right past the child without seeing her. He also said that scared children sometimes hide and don't answer when people call for them. Sadly, the search was stopped after 10 days because, according to Sheriff Tom Dawson, after conferring with medical authorities throughout the nation, a decision was made to wind the search down. Heavy rains and low temperatures have made the youngster's survival virtually impossible. Even as the official search wound down, disturbing details began to emerge that would haunt the case for decades to come. What had initially been treated as a tragic accident, a child lost in the wilderness, suddenly took on more sinister possibilities. Several days after the disappearance, a child came forward with a story that would turn this missing person case into something far more sinister. The child's words sent ice through the veins of every parent present. There was a strange man. He stepped out from behind a tree, just a few feet from Eileen, just moments before she vanished. The next day, another child came forward. Same story. Same terrifying details. According to both children, the man was dressed in a jogging suit. He had spoken to all three children briefly, Nylene and her two playmates. But while the other children had the instinct to walk away or run, Nylene had stayed. She had stood there with this stranger as her friends disappeared from view. One child would later tell police something that haunts investigators to this day. I heard Nylene say she had to follow the shadow. Follow the shadow. Four simple words that carry the weight of every parent's worst nightmare. Investigators and Nylene's family found the children's accounts credible for one crucial reason. They hadn't spoken to each other since the disappearance. There was no way they could have coordinated such similar stories. Moreover, these accounts aligned with other tips that had been coming in from people who had been in the area that day. By the time police officially began investigating this as an abduction rather than a missing child case, it was almost too late. Thousands of feet had already trampled through the woods. If there had been physical evidence of what happened to Nylene, it was now destroyed. The FBI joined the investigation. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children became involved. This was no longer just Montana's tragedy. This was now a federal case. A composite sketch was created based on the children's descriptions of the man in the jogging suit. When that sketch was distributed, Investigators made a chilling discovery. The face staring back at them from that drawing looked eerily similar to several men wanted for horrific crimes across the country. Individuals involved in crimes against children, including those connected to exploitation networks and suspects in other child abduction and homicide cases. In the days following the sketch's publication, hope flickered briefly. A photograph was discovered in an apartment where a suspect had been staying. The image showed a young girl who resembled Nyleen, but this girl appeared to have been beaten, her face bearing the marks of unthinkable cruelty. Nancy and Kim Marshall must have felt their hearts stop when they heard about this photograph. Could this be their Nyleen? Could their little girl with the dimpled cheeks and chipped tooth be alive but suffering? The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children carefully analyzed the photograph. After painstaking examination, they delivered crushing news. This was not Nyleen Marshall. One by one, the leads that had seemed so promising turned into dead ends. The sketch that resembled multiple criminals led nowhere concrete. The suspects were questioned and released. The hopes were raised and shattered again and again. Meanwhile, Nyleen's face began appearing everywhere. Billboards along highways carried her image. Milk cartons and grocery stores across the nation.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
Bore her photograph. Thousands of flyers were distributed in department stores and shopping centers. America was looking for Nyleen Marshall, but America couldn't find her. Back home in Montana, the Marshall family was slowly falling apart. The tight-knit family that had once shared laughter and bedtime stories was now held together only by grief and desperate hope. Nathan, Nyleen's 6-year-old brother, struggled to understand why his sister was gone. About a month after the disappearance, he told his mother something that would break any parent's heart. "Mom, my heart feels like it wants to cry." Nancy watched through the kitchen window one afternoon as Nathan pushed Nyleen's empty swing back and forth, before finally letting his arms drop to his sides. She watched as he walked over to his sister's tricycle, gently touched the seat where she used to sit, and then walked back into the house with the weight of the world on his small shoulders. "I really miss Nyleen," he told his mother that day. "I really love her, and I want to play with her. Do you think we'll ever find her?" How do you answer a question like that when you don't know the answer yourself? Then, everything changed again. 4 months after Nyleen went missing, a movie called Adam aired on national TV. It was about the kidnapping and murder of a boy named Adam Walsh. After the movie, they showed 55 photos of missing kids, and Nyleen's picture was one of them. No strong leads came from this, but a group called Child Find of America printed and shared posters with Nyleen's face, hoping someone might recognize her. In late 1985, someone started calling and sending letters, claiming to be the person who took Nyleen. This person contacted Child Find Incorporated and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and CMEC. The calls were traced to a public phone booth in Madison, Wisconsin, but once they were traced, the caller stopped contacting anyone. The last known call happened in May 1986, and the final letter was sent shortly after that. The letters included details that were never made public, though no one has ever shared what those details were. The writer may have hinted at who he was, saying he had lost his parents and 9-year-old sister in a car accident years before. I will read out the excerpts of the letters that were shown during the case's 1990 airing on Unsolved Mysteries.
I didn't want their person to try to get information from her. All I could tell them was that she was okay. I hope Child Find can get the following back to her family. I picked Kay up on the road in the Elkhorn Park area between Helena and Boulder. She was crying and frightened, and as I held her, she was shaking, and I decided that I would keep her and love her. I took her home with me. I have a nice investment income, and I can work at home, so I care for her myself all the time. I teach her at home, and she likes to go with me when I travel. Her hair is short and curly now, and she has really grown. She is about 45 inches and around 50 pounds. She has all 4 of her permanent upper and 2 of her lower incisors at this time. She takes a bath and brushes her teeth every day. She eats well. Her favorite meal is pizza and cherry. She would gladly recount to you trips to San Francisco, New York, Oklahoma City, New Orleans, Nashville, Chicago, Puerto Rico, and Canada. We were even in Britain for a month last year, and she loved it.
Some of what this man described did not sound good. This excerpt is one of the most disturbing. He revealed the true nature of his man's love. He described giving Nylene medicine each morning.
Only that I get it from the bathroom every morning. It is actually a spoonful of my redacted. It doesn't affect her physically. I have never redacted her in any other way. She is a sweet little girl, and it is because of how much I have grown to love her that I realize how much her family must miss her. But she is adjusted and seems happy. She trusts me and isn't afraid. We play a lot, and she laughs when we clown around. She smiles and acts coy when I tease her. She giggles when we snuggle, and hugs me sometimes for no apparent reason. I love her and I have her. I just can't let her go.
The letters and phone calls opened new avenues of investigation, but they also created new torments for the Marshall family. Every word was analyzed, every postmark studied, and every clue followed to its inevitable dead end. Investigators speculated that the kidnapper might be a traveling salesman or truck driver, someone whose work took him through Madison regularly. There was also speculation that after abducting Nylene, he had linked up with a female accomplice. When you eliminate the request for ransom, if money is not a motive, it must be to have a child of your own, observed Special Agent Neil Pertell. But despite the FBI's best efforts, the letter writer remained a ghost. The phone calls stopped. The correspondence ended. Once again, the Marshall family was left with nothing but questions and the terrible silence that followed. A teacher in British Columbia had thought that one of her students was Nylene K. Marshall. The student's father had always acted suspiciously, and she thought there was a resemblance and called authorities. When investigators followed up on this lead, they made an astounding discovery. The classmate wasn't Nylene, but she was another missing child, Monica Bonilla, who had been abducted by her biological father almost 8 years earlier. Monica was found alive and well in British Columbia and reunited with her mother. While Nancy and Kim were devastated that the girl wasn't their daughter, they found some comfort in knowing their tragedy had led to another family's reunion. "We were just tickled that at least some good came of it," Nancy said, her voice carrying both disappointment and genuine joy for the Bonilla family. But Nylene was still out there somewhere. In August 1991, hope surged through the Marshall family once again when Richard James Wilson walked into the Livingston police station and confessed to killing Nylene Marshall. Wilson had a history of mental illness and had been on probation since a 1984 conviction for sexual assault against a minor in Lewis and Clark County. Wilson didn't just confess to killing Nylene. He also claimed to have murdered a woman from Great Falls. He offered to lead investigators to both bodies, painting detailed pictures of burial sites and circumstances of death. For Nancy and Kim Marshall, this confession was both their greatest hope and their worst fear realized. If Wilson was telling the truth, they would finally know what happened to their daughter. But they would also know that she was never coming home. Wilson led investigators to where he claimed he had buried the unidentified woman from Great Falls. They searched meticulously, but found nothing. Then he took them to the Elkhorn Mountains, to the place where he said he had disposed of Nylene's body after killing her. Again, nothing. Based on the information he has given us, it behooves us to follow through and determine the validity of what Mr. Wilson had to say. One investigator stated, "Try to maintain professional objectivity while dealing with what was obviously a false confession." Wilson soon recanted his confessions entirely. Without physical evidence or corroborating details, there was insufficient evidence to charge him with any crime. He was released, leaving the Marshall family once again in limbo. 7 years later, in 1998, another glimmer of hope emerged from an unexpected source. A nurse at a New Orleans hospital contacted police after watching a rerun of Unsolved Mysteries. She told them about a strange incident from 2 years earlier, when a woman named Helena and an unidentified man had tried to admit her for childbirth. When hospital staff began asking routine questions about their identities and medical history, the couple acted strangely and quickly left the hospital. After providing the FBI with information about Helena, she was tracked down in Oklahoma City. Helena agreed to have blood drawn for comparison with Nylene's father. She said she remembered very little about her childhood, but thought her mother might have been named Nylene. For a brief moment, it seemed possible that Nylene Marshall had grown up, gotten pregnant, and was about to be found after 15 years. The blood test results were devastating. Helena was not Nylene Marshall. Tragically, Nancy Marshall was unalived while in Mexico in 1995. She went to the grave, not knowing the fate of her daughter. Nancy's death added another layer of tragedy to an already heartbreaking story. Now Kim Marshall was alone with his grief, and Nathan and Noreen had lost both their sister and their mother. The family that had once been complete was now fractured beyond repair. If Nylene Marshall were still alive today, she would be in her mid-40s. She might have children of her own, a life built on a foundation she doesn't even know is false. She might still believe the man who took her found her crying on a road and saved her. She might have no memory of Nancy and Kim, of Nathan and Noreen, of the family that never stopped looking for her. Or she might remember everything, trapped in a nightmare that began with the words, "Follow the shadow," and never ended. The case remains open. Somewhere out there, the truth about what happened to Nylene Marshall is waiting to be discovered. Until that day comes, her story serves as a reminder that evil can emerge from the shadows when we least expect it, and that the love of a family never dies, even when hope seems lost forever. Nathan Marshall, now a grown man, still remembers pushing his sister's empty swing that day so long ago. He still carries the weight of being the brother who couldn't protect her, the child who asked if they would ever find her. The question remains unanswered, but the love remains undiminished. In the end, that might be the most important truth of all, that love endures even when everything else fades away, even when shadows swallow our most precious treasures and never give them back. It was February 22, 1985. A mother kissed her 8-year-old daughter goodbye at the school bus stop, telling her, "I love you," words that would echo in her mind for decades to come. Because that little girl, with her bright hazel eyes and cabbage patch earmuffs, would never make it home. In broad daylight, on a quiet Pennsylvania road, Cherry Mahan vanished without a trace, leaving behind only tire tracks and a mystery that has haunted America for nearly 40 years. What happened in those final 150 yards between the bus stop and her front door? How does a child simply disappear on a snowy February afternoon with witnesses nearby? The answer would shake a community to its core and launch one of the most intensive missing child investigations in Pennsylvania history. Born on August 14, 1976, Cherry was the light of her young mother's life. Janice had given birth to Cherry when she was just 16 years old, the result of a traumatic assault when she was 15. But despite the difficult circumstances of her birth, Cherry became everything to her mother. "We were always together. We grew up together. She was my life," Janice would later say, her voice breaking with emotion. The little family found stability when Janice married Leroy McKinney, a Vietnam veteran who embraced Cherry as his own daughter. In late 1984, they moved to their home on Corn Planter Road, where Cherry attended Winfield Elementary School. Teachers describe her as bright, popular, and happy, a chatty little girl who made friends easily and brought joy wherever she went. That Friday morning started like any other. Cherry was excited because her mother had promised to take her on a play date when she returned from school. As the yellow school bus pulled away, carrying Cherry toward what should have been an ordinary day at school, neither mother nor daughter could have imagined it would be their last conversation. But somewhere in Butler County, someone was watching. Someone was waiting. And someone had already made a decision that would destroy this family forever. The afternoon of February 22nd unfolded with typical winter calm in Butler County. Snow blanketed the ground, creating a peaceful scene that masked the horror about to unfold. At Winfield Elementary, Cherry spent her day like any other 8-year-old, learning, laughing with her friends. At 4:10 p.m., the familiar rumble of the school bus echoed down Corn Planter Road. Inside their home, Leroy McKinney heard the bus slow to its usual stop. He had planned to walk down their 150-yard driveway to meet Cherry, as he often did. But Janice stopped him. "No, it's a nice day. Let her walk," she said, a decision that would haunt her for the rest of her life. Outside, Cherry stepped off the bus with three of her friends. Debbie Burke, the mother of one of Cherry's friends, had followed the school bus in her car, a common practice for parents picking up their children. She watched as Cherry's three friends climbed into her vehicle. Then she saw something that would make her the last person to witness Cherry Mahan alive and free. Parked near the bus stop sat a van, bluish-green in color, from the 1970s, possibly a 1976 Dodge. But this wasn't just any van. Painted on its side was a distinctive mural, a skier traversing snow-capped mountains. It was the kind of detail that should have made the van easy to find. Instead, it became the most haunting piece of evidence in a case that would never be solved. Debbie watched as Cherry walked past this van, seemingly without concern. The little girl turned the corner and began her short journey up the driveway toward home, a walk that should have taken no more than 2 or 3 minutes. She appeared calm, unhurried, just a child eager to see her mother and start their promised play date. But Cherry Mahan would never reach her front door. In those brief moments, somewhere along that 150-yard stretch of gravel driveway, she vanished as completely as if the earth had swallowed her whole. Inside the McKinney home, the minutes ticked by with agonizing slowness. Janice glanced at the clock. 4:15, then 4:20. Where was Cherry? The walk from the bus stop never took more than 5 minutes, even when she stopped to play in the snow. Leroy felt it first, that cold dread that starts in your stomach and spreads through your entire body. Something was wrong. At 4:25, 15 minutes after the bus had arrived, both parents knew their world was about to collapse. They rushed outside, calling Cherry's name. Their voices echoed across the empty landscape, met only by silence. Janice ran toward the bus stop, while Leroy searched the driveway. The fresh snow should have shown Cherry's footprints, the path of a little girl in beige boots walking home. But there were no footprints leading to their house. What they found instead sent ice through their veins, tire impressions in the driveway soil, approximately 50 yards from their home. Someone had been here. Someone had driven onto their property, and now their daughter was gone. The next few hours blurred together in a nightmare of phone calls and sirens. Police arrived within minutes, followed by search teams, bloodhounds, and helicopters. As darkness fell over Butler County, the search expanded. Volunteers poured in from surrounding communities, neighbors, strangers, anyone willing to help find a missing child. By the end of that first night, over 250 people were scouring the area around Cornplanter Road. They searched barns, abandoned buildings, wooded areas, and frozen ponds. They called Cherry's name until their voices were hoarse. The police worked through the night, interviewing witnesses and gathering evidence. Debbie Burke's testimony about the mysterious van became crucial. She described it in detail, the bluish-green color, the mounted mural, and the way it had been positioned near the bus stop. It wasn't a vehicle she recognized from the neighborhood, and its timing seemed too coincidental to ignore. But even with this critical lead, investigators faced a terrifying reality. In the span of just a few minutes, on a quiet country road in broad daylight, an 8-year-old girl had been erased from existence. No screams had been heard. No struggle had been witnessed. Cherry Mahan had simply walked around a corner and disappeared forever. The investigation into Cherry Mahan's disappearance became one of the most extensive missing child cases Pennsylvania had ever seen. Detective teams worked around the clock, following every lead, no matter how small. The community response was overwhelming. Within days, local residents had raised $39,000 as a reward for Cherry's safe return, with a local business adding another $10,000 for information leading to arrest and conviction. Police quickly eliminated the possibility of a ransom kidnapping. The McKinney family was working class, not wealthy enough to attract kidnappers seeking money. This realization led investigators to a more chilling conclusion. Whoever took Cherry had done so for other reasons. The thought of what those reasons might be haunted everyone involved in the case. Early in the investigation, police theorized that Cherry likely knew her abductor. The fact that she had walked past the van without apparent fear suggested she might have recognized either the vehicle or the person inside. This theory was both comforting and terrifying. Comforting because it suggested Cherry hadn't been taken by a complete stranger. Terrifying because it meant someone in their circle of trust had betrayed that trust in the most horrific way possible. All family members were quickly eliminated as suspects. Leroy McKinney's alibi was solid. He had been inside the house when Cherry disappeared. Janice's whereabouts were also accounted for. Extended family members were interviewed and cleared. This left investigators facing the possibility that Cherry's abductor was someone from the community, perhaps someone who knew the family's routines, who knew when Cherry would be walking home alone. The mysterious van became the focus of intense investigation. Appeals for information about the bluish-green Dodge with the ski mural generated several responses. Witnesses came forward claiming they had seen a similar vehicle in New Kensington, traveling toward Mount Pleasant. Even more intriguing, other witnesses reported seeing a blue car following the van. Most significant was the report that the van had been repainted black within 1 or 2 weeks of Cherry's disappearance. This detail suggested that whoever owned the van knew it had been seen and identified as connected to the crime. The quick repainting indicated planning and awareness. This wasn't a random act by someone who panicked afterward. Despite these leads, the van was never located. Police checked every registration for similar vehicles in Pennsylvania and surrounding states. They visited body shops and auto parts stores. They followed up on hundreds of tips from people who thought they had seen the van. But it was as if the vehicle had vanished as completely as Cherry herself. As weeks turned into months, investigators faced a heartbreaking reality. Despite their best efforts, despite the community support, despite the extensive searches and countless interviews, they were no closer to finding Cherry or identifying her abductor than they had been on that first terrible night. The case began to take on a different character. It was no longer a rescue mission. It was a hunt for answers, for justice, for some way to give Janice McKinney the closure she desperately needed. 3 months after Cherry's disappearance, something unprecedented happened in the world of missing children cases. A national direct mailing company printed thousands of postcards featuring Cherry's photograph alongside the question that would become iconic. Have you seen me? These postcards were mailed across America, tucked into telephone bills and utility statements, reaching millions of households. Alongside Cherry's photo was an artist's rendering of the distinctive van. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children featured Cherry as the first missing child to be depicted on these nationwide postcards, setting a precedent that would help countless other families in the years to come. For Janice McKinney, seeing her daughter's face on postcards across the country was both hopeful and heartbreaking. Every postcard represented a chance that someone, somewhere, might have seen Cherry. But it also meant accepting that her little girl was truly gone, that she wasn't going to walk through the front door with an innocent explanation for her absence. The years that followed were a testament to a mother's love and determination. Janice never gave up searching, never stopped hoping, and never stopped believing that someday she would get answers. In 1998, 13 years after Cherry vanished, Janice made one of the most difficult decisions of her life. Although Pennsylvania law would have allowed her to have Cherry declared legally dead after 7 years, she had resisted. Declaring her daughter dead felt like giving up, like abandoning hope. But finally, she petitioned the court to have Cherry legally declared deceased. The legal proceedings were emotionally devastating. Speaking to the media afterward, Janice's words captured the unique hell of losing a child without knowing what happened. When people die, you have a body. You kiss them upon the face. You put them in the ground. And you say goodbye. That's something I never had. This is not over. We'll always look for Cherry. If nothing else, she'll always be alive in our hearts. Before the legal declaration, Janice donated the $50,000 reward money to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. It was an act of tremendous generosity from a woman who had already given everything, using her tragedy to help other families facing similar nightmares. In 2000, 15 years after Cherry's disappearance, technology offered new hope. A computer-generated image showed how Cherry might look at age 23. These age progression photos were mailed to thousands of households across America, part of an ongoing effort to keep Cherry's case in the public eye. The response was immediate, but ultimately heartbreaking. Tips poured in from across the country. People who thought they recognized the woman in the photo, who believed they had seen Cherry living under a different identity. Each tip was thoroughly investigated, each lead carefully followed, but none led to Cherry. January 2011 brought what investigators called potentially crucial information. Pennsylvania State Police received a tip they deemed more specific than anything they had received in years. The information came from someone known to Cherry, someone who claimed to have knowledge that could lead police to a known specific actor or actors. The public was told this information indicated that Cherry was unlikely to still be alive. Pennsylvania State Police Officer Robert McGraw, speaking about the case, offered insight into the investigation's direction. I believe Cherry was abducted by someone she knows very well, and I believe this person had the ability to basically lure Cherry into their vehicle without her giving it a second thought prior to her disappearance. I can't imagine if that was my child. I can't imagine the pain her mother must wake up with every day. Despite the promising nature of this 2011 tip, it too failed to yield concrete results. The investigation continued, but the specific details of this potentially crucial information were never released to the public, leaving everyone to wonder what investigators had learned and why it hadn't led to an arrest. In 2014, another false hope emerged. Investigators received a tip that Cherry was alive and living under an assumed name in Michigan. The woman in question had been adopted as a child and was unsure of her precise origins. For a brief moment, it seemed possible that Cherry had somehow survived and had grown up not knowing her true identity. DNA testing quickly shattered this hope. The woman was not Cherry Mahan. Once again, a promising lead dissolved into disappointment, leaving investigators and Cherry's family back where they started, with questions but no answers, with hope but no resolution. The pattern was becoming tragically familiar. Initial excitement over a new lead, intensive investigation, and ultimately, crushing disappointment. Each false hope was like reopening a wound that had never fully healed. For Janice, every phone call from police brought the possibility of closure, but usually delivered only more questions. In 2018, 33 years after Cherry's disappearance, Janice McKinney received an anonymous handwritten letter that arrived. The contents were specific, detailed, and chilling. The letter described who had murdered Cherry, why they had done so, and where her remains were buried. It wasn't vague or general. It contained specific information that only someone with direct knowledge could have known. The author concluded with words that were both comforting and haunting. "I pray you find some peace after you find her body." For Janice, receiving this letter was both devastating and hopeful. After decades of wondering, of imagining countless scenarios, someone was finally claiming to have answers. But the letter also confirmed her worst fears, that Cherry had been murdered, that she hadn't survived to grow up and have a life of her own. Police investigated the letter thoroughly, but like so many leads before it, the information couldn't be verified or acted upon in a way that brought charges against anyone. The letter remained anonymous, its claims unproven, leaving Janice in the same agonizing position she had occupied for over three decades. As 2020 arrived, bringing with it the 35th anniversary of Cherry's disappearance, Janice made a revelation that shed new light on the case. She disclosed her conviction that while she didn't believe Cherry's biological father was involved in the abduction, she believed individuals known to him were responsible. This theory is connected to the darkest chapter of Janice's own past. She revealed that prior to Cherry's disappearance, no one had believed her claims that Cherry had been conceived through rape. The shame and disbelief she faced as a teenage mother had isolated her, making it difficult to seek help or support. Now, decades later, she wondered if this connection to her past held the key to understanding what happened to her daughter. Janice also revealed a detail that haunted her daily. February 22, 1985, was the first day she hadn't stood at the bottom of the driveway to meet Cherry when the school bus arrived. "On any other day," she said, "I would have been there." The implication was clear. If she had been at the bus stop as usual, Cherry might never have been taken. This revelation added another layer of torment to Janice's grief. Not only had she lost her daughter, but she blamed herself for breaking routine on that one crucial day. The what-ifs were endless and torturous. What if she had met the bus? What if Leroy had walked down a driveway? What if they had insisted Cherry wait inside until they could escort her home? In 2019, Janice spoke publicly about her ongoing anguish, emphasizing her belief that an anonymous tip from the public could finally provide the closure her family craved. "I just wish someone would come forth and tell me what happened," she said. "That's all I pray for all the time, is just to know." These words captured the essence of her decades-long ordeal. It wasn't just about justice anymore, though that remained important. It was about knowledge, about finally understanding what happened in those few minutes when her world changed forever. Today, nearly four decades later, Cherry Mahan's disappearance remains one of America's most haunting unsolved cases. The investigation continues, with Pennsylvania State Police still receiving tips and following leads. Technology has advanced dramatically since 1985, offering new possibilities for solving old crimes. But Cherry's case remains stubbornly unsolved. The impact of her disappearance extends far beyond her immediate family. The case changed how America thinks about missing children, contributing to the development of systems and protocols that help other families. The postcards featuring Cherry's face were revolutionary for their time, creating a template that would be used to help find thousands of other missing children. But for those who knew and loved Cherry, the statistics and systems matter less than the gaping hole left by her absence. Her friends, now middle-aged women with families of their own, still gather annually to remember the bright 8-year-old who vanished from their lives. They speak of how becoming mothers deepened their understanding of Janice's loss, making them realize the true magnitude of her strength in surviving such tragedy. The annual remembrance dinners continue, serving as both a celebration of Cherry's life and an acknowledgement of the ongoing loss. Stories are shared, memories recounted, and tears shed. These gatherings keep Cherry's memory alive while providing support for those still carrying the weight of her disappearance. Janice McKinney, now in her 60s, continues to hope for answers. The optimistic 16-year-old who doted on her baby daughter has been transformed by grief into a woman of remarkable resilience. She has survived the unthinkable, continuing to function and even thrive while carrying a burden that would crush many people. Her message remains consistent. Someone knows what happened to Cherry. Whether through direct involvement or secondhand knowledge, someone holds the key to solving this case. She appeals regularly to the public, asking that person to find the courage to come forward to finally end her family's decades of uncertainty. A child vanishes into thin air in front of his entire family. No one heard a scream. No one saw him leave. 6-year-old Dennis Martin was playing hide and seek in the Smoky Mountains. Then he was just gone. Search teams came. Dogs came. Helicopters scanned for days. Nothing. The day before Dennis Martin would have turned 7, his father shouted his name from the sky, fighting back tears in a last desperate plea to bring him home. Maybe Dennis heard it. Maybe he tried to answer. Maybe the wind that whipped and wailed across Spence Field drowned out the words of father and son alike. The day couldn't have been better for camping. Bill Martin didn't see a single cloud in the sky as he sat down on a knoll in Spence Field that Saturday afternoon of June 14, 1969. Martin, an architect in Knoxville, had driven to Cades Cove with his father Clyde and his 2 sons, Doug, who is 9, and Dennis, 6, the day before for a weekend of hiking and camping. Tomorrow would be Father's Day. Dennis would turn 7 in 6 days. And this weekend marked another turn in a family tradition that dated back more than half a century. Martin men helped settle the cove, tilling the rich bottomland soil at the start of every spring and driving cattle up the mountain to range on the tall grass in treeless meadows like Spence Field, known as Mountain Balts. Every June, fathers and sons trekked uphill and set out salt licks to last the herds until the fall drive down the mountain to market. The creation of the park in 1934 ended that farming, but the tradition lived on as a Martin family reunion. This year marked the first time Dennis joined the trip. Denny, as his parents called him, was small but strong, about 4 feet tall and 55 pounds with dark brown eyes and wavy brown hair. He was about 6 months behind his age group in school, but field smart and fearless. He'd never camped away from home before, but knew how to handle himself in the woods. Saturday began with breakfast at nearby Russell Field, where the family had spent the night, and a hike to Spence where other Martin relatives waited at the camping shelter. With lunch eaten and the dishes done, adults settled down at the knoll to talk and enjoy the view while Dennis, Doug, and 2 more boys ran and played in the field. Just before 4:30 p.m., the boys put their heads together and whispered as the adults watched. Then they scattered, Doug and the others to the south, Dennis to the north, and west toward the Tennessee side. The grown-ups chuckled and waited. Bill Martin and the others jumped in pretend surprise when the boys burst out of the brush behind them with shrieks and laughter. After a few minutes, maybe 2 or 3 by the father's count, no more than 5, he insisted, came the question, Where's Dennis? The boys lost sight of him when he headed west. They didn't want his red shirt to give them away. Father and grandfather called his name. He didn't answer. The group fanned across the field, splitting up to check the trails. Hours ticked by. Clyde Martin, the grandfather, hiked to the Cades Cove Ranger Station to report Dennis missing. Bill Martin crossed paths with a park naturalist headed up the trail from Cades Cove. He'd seen nothing. Clouds gathered overhead as a breeze swept across the field. In the distance, thunder rumbled. The storm broke with a sudden fury, dumping nearly 3 inches of rain over the next few hours that sent the family scurrying to the shelter and turned the trails to rivers of mud. High winds drowned out the calls for Dennis, along with any chance at hearing an answer. Dennis walked away with nothing but the clothes on his back and the shoes on his feet. No hat, no rain gear, nothing to protect him. Temperatures that night dropped into the low 50s, chilling campers to the bone. The family ventured from the shelter occasionally to call his name, to no avail. "I doubt he ever heard them," said Dwight McCarter, a retired park ranger who's helped track more than 2 dozen people lost in the mountains. "I don't know that they could have heard him. To be a child caught out in that kind of storm in those kinds of temperatures without shelter, it's not a good thing. Their system isn't built like adults. Hypothermia sets in quick." McCarter and other rangers assembled for search and rescue duty at 5 a.m. the next day, June 15th. Getting to the scene took most of the morning as the rangers struggled past flooded streams, standing water, and washed out roads and trails. Park officials used trucks and jeeps to haul searchers to Spence Field. By afternoon, more than 240 people had converged on the scene, from rangers to local rescue squad volunteers to Boy Scout troops, with more on the way. The crowd included Dennis's mother, Violet, who learned at church her son had disappeared. "I have a feeling we're going to find him," she said. "Maybe God sent this ordeal to us so we could appreciate things more." For every truck and volunteer, McCarter saw a potential sign of Dennis lost, trampled, washed away, churned to mud beneath a tire. He'd grown up in the Smokies, taught from childhood how to recognize the broken twigs, the disturbed ant trails, and other clues that point to a lost traveler's track in the wild. He still shakes his head at the thought. "All those people," he said. "That's a lot of footprints. All those trucks. We searched and searched and searched. Something should have been found. But you have to know what to look for. Get just a few of us trackers in first, and give us a chance." Park officials later acknowledged bungling the search from the start with too many overeager volunteers, too many inexperienced eyes, and too many careless feet. Nominal commanders on the scene soon lost control, overwhelmed by the number of searchers. Some volunteers had never set foot in the park before. Some didn't know how to use a compass. Everyone kept feeling that the boy would be found in the next hour. And it was probably this reason why the search organization did not keep pace with a rapid manpower buildup. Keith Nielsen, who went on to serve as park superintendent, wrote in an after-action review, "We failed to realize the need for quick organization. It was the most intensive and large-scale search that any of the park personnel had ever participated in." That realization didn't come until months later. Searcher ranks ballooned in the days that followed. More volunteers drove up in more vehicles with water, food, and supplies. The details of the case, a missing child, a sudden disappearance, a race against the elements in the nation's most visited national park, made for instant headlines. President Richard Nixon notified park officials he'd be keeping up with the search, prompted by his friend U.S. Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee. Airmen from McGee-Tyson National Guard Base arrived, along with rescue squad members from across Tennessee, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Georgia. Green Berets on a training exercise in the nearby Nantahala National Forest showed up to help. By Monday, June 16th, the crowd topped 300 people. By the next day, more than 365. Rain continued throughout the week, and rangers hauled in gravel to shore up roads rendered impassable by flash flooding. By the seventh day, Search ranks peaked at 1,400 people. One volunteer accidentally shot himself in the leg. Another broke an arm when he fell off a bridge. Today we would not have anywhere near that number, said Jordan, the deputy superintendent. Over 100 people is considered a good-sized search in this day and age. We can manage those folks. But in those days, we just didn't know how to go about looking for somebody who's lost. It's the wilderness version of the needle in a haystack. Helicopters flew in, but spent much of the time grounded by rain and fog. Once airborne, spotters found the leafy tree canopy impenetrable. Search dogs sniffed the woods in vain. We never did get enough to run a track, said former State Representative H.E. Biddle Jr., who offered his bloodhounds for the search. We just didn't have anything to go on, and there'd already been so many in and out of there. The searchers weren't squeamish. Men and women hacked their way into the park's deepest thickets. Some so dense searchers had a belly crawl to get through. A crew of Green Berets ran out of rations and barbecued a rattlesnake. It will take a miracle to find the boy or even a trace of him, an airman told one reporter. But I believe in miracles, and so do the rest of us out here. We're not about to give up. We just got to pull this miracle off. One of the only clues discovered came on Tuesday, June 17th, the fourth day of the search. A pair of hikers stumbled across a faint set of small tracks along a water break in the Eagle Creek area, about a mile below Spence Field. They followed the prints about 300 yards before losing the trail at the edge of stream. One appeared to be a bare footprint, the other a shoe print, each about child-sized. Rangers made a cast of the prints. The Martins said the prints looked too big for Dennis. Park officials dismissed the tracks as left by Boy Scouts from a search party. Green Berets reported they'd already made a sweep. When we get through with an area and say he's not there, he's not there, said Lieutenant Colonel Howard Kinney, the commander. McCarter, the retired ranger, thinks his bosses gave up too early. Standing at the mouth of the water break today, he looks back and sighs in regret. They didn't find tracks from a bunch of kids, he said. They found tracks from one kid. He was by himself, and none of those scouts who'd been through were barefoot. That would be reasonable, that he might have hit this trail. If it was dark, this looks like a trail. If you didn't have a flashlight, and you didn't know the terrain, and you're 6 years old, he pauses. You'd be awfully young to have to make those kinds of decisions on your own. As the search dragged on, tips poured in from psychics, astrologers, and self-styled sleuths. Jean Dixon, who claimed to have predicted President John Kennedy's assassination, reported a vision of Dennis, still breathing. Searchers would find him, she foretold, behind a waterfall on the North Carolina side of Spence Field. Yet they found nothing. On this day, Bill Martin took to the air in a Tennessee Highway Patrol helicopter to call for his son from a bullhorn. Searchers questioned whether the sound could even be heard over the wind and the roar of the chopper blades. Dennis would have turned 7 that Friday, June 20th. Rangers watched for buzzards and drew up plans for how to recover the boy's body. Sunday, June 22nd, marked the 8th day. Searchers had covered 56 square miles of ground, all with no results. The odds Dennis could have survived this long, with no food in his pocket, no coat on his back, and no ripe berries on the vines, dwindled hourly. On June 25th, the Martin family headed home. On June 29th, park officials suspended all major search operations. A handful of rangers continued efforts until September 11th, when the park declared the search closed. The search cost 13,420 man-hours and roughly $70,000. Equivalent to about a $500,000 in today's dollars. We've done everything we know to do, said Lee Sneddon, the chief ranger. The Martins offered a $5,000 reward for anyone with information leading to Dennis. Bill Martin told reporters he suspected his son might have been kidnapped. I've got nothing to go on, no evidence, the father said. But it's a possibility, and the only one we have that the boy is still alive. The case took a new twist when Harold Key, a state highway engineer from Middle Tennessee, approached park officials more than a month after Dennis disappeared. Key said he visited Cade's Cove with his family that weekend from Carthage and wandered into the woods, hoping to see a bear. He couldn't retrace his steps, but felt sure he'd been somewhere near Spence Field that Saturday, sometime between 6 to 7 p.m. When we got about half a mile or maybe three-quarters of a mile from the car, we heard a scream, Key told News Sentinel reporter Carson Brewer. A trouble scream. An enormous, sickening scream. We couldn't tell which direction it came from, but it sounded like it came from higher on the mountain to me. Minutes later, something moved in the brush. I looked across the creek and saw a man in the bushes, Key recalled. I couldn't tell much about him, because he was going down the creek toward the cars. He was definitely trying to keep from being seen. I thought maybe he was a moonshiner. Key said he crossed the creek and found what looked like a crudely drawn map on a scrap of paper about where the man would have been. When he came back, he noticed the only other car parked at the roadside, an older model white Chevrolet gone. He didn't learn about Dennis Martin until the next day. At first he kept quiet, but I got to thinking that maybe the scream had something to do with that boy's disappearance. Rangers ultimately concluded Key must have been at Sea Branch, a small stream that crosses the south leg of Cade's Cove Loop Road, west of Rowan's Creek. That would have put him at least 5 miles from Spence Field, closer to 7 or as much as 9 miles away by trails. To cover that distance in the space of 2 hours or less would have taken Olympic effort, especially for someone avoiding the trails. That's without accounting for how a kidnapper or killer could have crept up on Dennis in the open meadow on a sunny day. Key stuck to his story through the decades, all the way to his death at age 94. But park officials then and now say there's nothing that connects the dots between whatever he saw in Dennis. As a scenario, I think that is the most far-fetched, said Jordan, the deputy superintendent. Rangers and agents of the FBI's Knoxville office ran down dozens of tips, including one from a woman who claimed she'd seen a boy who looked like Dennis in the backseat of a passing car in Knoxville. Yet nothing held up. On July 3rd, McCarter and a small crew of the remaining searchers reported a stench on the wind as they headed up the West Prong Trail below Spence Field. It was just a smell that wasn't an animal, I didn't think, he recalled. I'd smell dead, barren deer. They smell different. A dead crow. Park officials radioed back. That area was checked already. Move on. McCarter questions that call to this day. It wasn't a crow, he said. I've smelled a dead crow. This was worse. The spot would have been downwind from the water break at Eagle Creek, where hikers found the child-sized tracks 4 days into the search. How certain can he be today of what he smelled? On a scale of 1 to 10, about a 5. I don't know what it was, he said.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
It's worth checking. It should have been checked. In July 1985, a man approached McCarter with a story of finding a child-sized skeleton in ground disturbed by an uprooted tree in Big Hollow near Tremont years earlier. The man said he hadn't reported it because he'd been hunting ginseng illegally. A crew of 30 men searched the hollow, to no avail. In the 1990s, a man contacted park officials for details about the case. He thought he might be Dennis Martin, but he wasn't. Bill Martin died in 2014, never knowing what became of his son. The family hasn't discussed the case publicly since the search ended and didn't want to talk for this story. Armchair detectives still debate the case, Whether Dennis was kidnapped, mauled by a bear, stumbled off a cliff in the dark or died of hunger, thirst, or exposure. Jordan, the park's deputy superintendent, said he doesn't expect to find an answer. Time, weather, scavenging animals, and the forest itself have by now erased any surviving clues. It can be really hard to imagine that you can have so many searchers in the woods and not be able to find somebody, he said. So you look for some other explanation. For me, I don't have to look for another explanation because I know it can happen so easily. I think he wandered off in the wrong direction, ended up on the wrong trail, and then just kept going. Rescuers across the globe still use Dennis Martin's disappearance as a training exercise. The National Park Service overhauled its search and rescue procedures in the wake of the case, and the lessons learned have saved lives for the past 50 years by Jordan's estimate. Searchers in the Smokies have failed to find only 4 other missing people since. You have now people searching in the Australian outback who know the name Dennis Martin, Jordan said. I would say that was one of those signature moments. The science of search management that has evolved since 1969 is really a lasting legacy that will go beyond all of our lives and help other people all around the world. Spence Field today barely looks like the meadow of a half century ago. Trees cover what was once open ground. Forest stuff, dead leaves, fungus, dirt, and other debris coats the earth, deep and pillowy soft. Even McCarter barely recognizes some of the spots. For every year, nature layers up about an inch, he said on a recent visit, and it's been a lot of years. And the winds still blow across Spence Field.